Now, Jim, show this gentleman how you can dance and sing.
That's my attitude towards the Western powers. If you want to say there's no war, it's fine. Don't go crying for your mummy when that comes.
America today finds herself in a unique situation. She's the only country in history in a position to become involved in a bloodless revolution.
If America does not respond creatively to the challenge to banish racism, some future historian will have to say that a great civilization died because it lacked the soul and commitment to make justice a reality for all men.
When a system doesn't work for the majority of the people, you gotta change the system.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is your brother, Vladimir Dietz. Welcome to this Class War Battle for podcast episode. How y'all doing? This election has kind of preoccupied me. And, the reason why I created the Class War Battlefield podcast, one of the reasons, was to look at all of these myths of capitalism and to explain why those myths just simply aren't true, and to bring you information about the history of capitalism that you may not know, that information that is massively important to our everyday life. And so, I'll be honest, you know, the second phase of this podcast, which would be, you know, Donald Trump and beyond, has been preoccupied with explaining him and the ideas surrounding his presidency, the ideas surrounding his election, and then trying to expose the hollowness of ideological alignments that have crept up throughout these past, you know, 7-8 years. In other words, well, I've talked about many, many things. I've just not stuck to what I wanted the podcast to originally be. So I'm going to do what I can over the coming year to get that back on track, because there's just so much information that you as a citizen in this country should know. There is just so much information, and information that is readily available if you want to find it, and if you want to consider it. For instance, there's a book which I am probably later on towards the end of the year going to be dissecting, releasing a series of episodes, dissecting it. It is a book supposedly written to counter the Communist Manifesto. It is called the Capitalist Manifesto. I found this book about 9 years ago, 8 or 9 years ago, and read through it and found it interesting. It is not a book that is wholly condemnable. There is much to like about it, but it is still a book, nonetheless, that speaks to a reality which is mythified. It's not often true. So that's definitely a series of episodes that I want to do, breaking down that book chapter by chapter, and sometimes even taking a couple of chapters to really, or excuse me, a couple of shows to really break down a chapter and bring you the information that you need to understand it and to really digest it. Because, you know, these things matter. these things do matter. And if we are going to go into this wonderful decade with our eyes open, we have to open our eyes. So first and foremost, let me just say that coming up, you're going to hear a pre-recorded section that I produced as a response to what's going on with Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders. It's not what you think. I know you're probably sick of hearing about it, but it's really, as you know how I work, ladies and gentlemen. I am not a typical commentator. I look at things very differently than other people, and this is no different. This looks at feminism and the victimization which tends to go with it, and where feminism may be going wrong in its desire to correct, in the European historical context, a slight of women. And there is a slight. So I'm going to be talking about that. I want you to, get ready for that. Back to what I was saying, though. We need to open, in order to go into this decade with our eyes open, we have to open our eyes. I see this network, and I think it's unfair to call it a network because it's not all connected, even though there are definitely connections within it. This network of money-making, progressive entities, a lot of mostly YouTube shows, of folks who have various I would say professions, and have wonderful experience, which gives their commentary color, and in relationship to the progressivism which they are talking about. But one of the lacking aspects of a lot of the commentary that I watch is a systemic understanding. And I hate using that word because it's been so anesthetized. It's been sapped of its energy and its power, because people have been misusing it and mischaracterizing it in academia. But a lot of the people who I listen to calling themselves progressives, I understand that these people like Bernie Sanders because Bernie Sanders can progress a conversation and possibly even policy desires which they have forward. But these people are not socialists. They're nowhere near socialists. And the reason most of them don't ascribe to socialism, and I see, Dr. King's birthday is coming up. I'm waiting for the number of people who come out and talk about Dr. King being a democratic socialist and, how wonderful it is, when none of these people have studied Dr. King extensively. I know this because I have. But the reason most of these folks aren't socialists is because they don't have a systemic analysis for capitalism. They don't look at capitalism as a systemic evolutionary force that is crippling the society, because that is what capitalism does. There is still hope within them that you can save capitalism, that you can amend it, that you can make it work better, because they look at a place like Sweden and they say, well, Sweden, which is a democratic socialist country, Sweden makes it work. They have socialistic tendencies, but they're pretty much a capitalistic society. They admit that they think this, I see it in their analyses. I see it in how they talk about the problems facing the society. And here's why they can continue to believe these things. Because they don't want to face a couple of truths. The first truth. Sweden, as great a place as it is geographically, culturally the same. The history of Sweden binds it together. Its culture is similar. It doesn't have a lot of, well, I guess I can't say 100% a lot of, but it doesn't have a lot of people from other places throughout the world who supposedly influenced its culture as it grew up. That's Sweden. The same thing, Germany is the same way. It has a little bit more, obviously, in the realm of immigrants. But Sweden is really, and I'm blanking on the word that I'm trying to think of here, but they're really, it's one culture, it's one people. They don't have to deal with a lot of external exposition from other places in the globe. So they're free to do whatever they want. Number two, they get to benefit from colonialist expansions throughout the world. Now, if there was never colonialism, I'm pretty sure because of how, Sweden has evolved, that they'd probably still be pretty friendly and have the stuff that they need from around the world. But one has to always remember, capitalism did not develop in a vacuum. Capitalism developed out of feudalism, mercantilism, militarism, imperialism. People forget, imperialism was militaristic. It came from a continent that was obsessed with military battles. Then you had imperialism, then you had colonialism, and capitalism grew up right alongside that. Sweden benefits from those conquests, even though it didn't conquer those people by itself. It benefits from those channels that are open. The United States, on the other hand, right now, is the purveyor of those conquests. They keep those conquests going. That's why the country has, 1,000 bases across the world. It's because this country, maintains the colonialist system, which they inherited when World War II came to a close. If you look at the history of many of these bases, you'd realize there were bases in that region prior to the U.S. establishing their own. Some of them, they literally just took over from other countries. The U.S. does this because there is a deadly fear. It is a deadly fear among the major colonialist powers that if the world had its say, I'm talking here South America, I'm talking about Africa, and many places in Asia, if the world had its say, it would eject Europe, the Anglo-European countries, Europe, North America, Canada might be spared because they're a nice group, but they would punish them for what they have done to their countries. And in fact, this is one of the reasons why the U.S. will never leave the Middle East. People forget this. And I was surprised that a lot of people, and look, I'll be honest, I kind of forgot it too, but I was surprised that a lot of people didn't mention this. back in the 1970s. I can't, you know, it was OPEC. I just can't remember what prompted it. But the U.S. pissed off the Arab countries in the 1970s, and they turned the spigot off when it came to oil. That's one of the reasons the United States suddenly had an oil shortage. And that was one of the reasons Jimmy Carter said, we need to get off of oil. And so, the U.S. can't leave the Middle East. There is a fear that if they left, and of course now the Anglo-European Alliance has completely messed these countries up. So where you used to have stable intellectuals who were revolutionary, yes, but they were stable enough to bind their societies together, they've excised most of them, murdered a lot of them. And so you have people in power and people who have been given power who are lackeys, most of them. Not all of them, but most of them. Who are lackeys, who don't have the wherewithal, the revolutionary spirit to really craft a workable nation. And so, to some extent, they're kind of right to be afraid. Because they took out all the people who would want to probably work with them. And they've created a mess. So, outside of all that, though, Sweden still gets to benefit from that. I'm not saying that, like, Sweden, you know, is contributing troops to go across the world. No, but the presence of the Anglo-European force, which now extends to America, allows for them to still be able to get the things they need to make their country what it is. And in fact, that's what allows France to live above its means. Because France does not have the natural resources, I hate that word, but the natural extractions. It doesn't have the things that you would think that it would need to be as prosperous as it is. And France is not, you know, as prosperous as most people think, but it is still pretty prosperous. In fact, something that is happening which does not get much coverage is that the old colonial possessions in Africa are starting to raise some hell, H-A-I-L, y'all, for them of y'all who ain't from the country, because France has been extorting hundreds of billions of francs from these countries for the last, you know, 60, 70 years. And these countries are tired of that. They've started, you know, forming an alliance to break the stranglehold of the franc on their countries, which will be happening soon. The colonialist project is still feeding Europe. And it's still feeding the United States. The problem is, and this is something that I'm not sure if progressives know, because again, without a systemic analysis, if you've never read the book Slavery and Capitalism, you might want to read that book. Eric Williams, if I remember correctly. Progressives who have not had a systemic analysis of this, it's hard for them to see this. But the problem is, since colonialism is still feeding America, the idea after World War II obviously was to enrich corporations here in the States with that colonialist booty. And then to allow that to, if you would, trickle down to the populace. Which it was working in the 60s, the 50s and the 60s, when, you know, the U.S. really didn't have anybody who could hang with it. And this to me is a great metaphor for capitalism, because when this is why capitalism doesn't want any other system to compete with it. Because if it has a system that competes with it, it loses. The United States was flying high when it didn't have anyone who competed with it. But as soon as the 70s got online, you've seen Japan starting to rise in the late 70s, Europe beginning to get itself back together in the early 70s. As soon as this started to happen, the 1980s hits, and what's the problem? Japan starts eating the United States lunch. When they didn't have competition, it was fine. Also, when you had loyalty to the United States by those at the top of the economic order, it was fine. Because that would mean that all of the colonialist excesses, or the colonial excesses, would be then channeled into the United States, and they would ricochet around here for a while before they went elsewhere. But with a generation who was more concerned with making money, and this happens with colonialism, it becomes about the money, because you're going towards the, quote, resources. And the money is the resource. So you want it, the money. That's what these new colonialist businessmen wanted. They wanted the money. So they didn't care, about continuing to bring in the colonial booty to the United States in order to have it ricochet around and benefit the U.S. It became just about making more. Now, to be fair, the U.S. has always had that. They've always had those greedy people. But for a while, they were able to keep them in check. Well, it didn't happen. When you have a system which is so exploitative that it sanctions the murder of workers who say, you got to pay us better. When it sanctions the murder of civilians who say, you can't treat our community this way. You can't just poison our community. You just can't come in here and exploit us and not take care of the community. When you have a system which says it is fine for a country with technological advances that make it almost look like Star Wars compared to the other, to the people who it wants to impose its will on. When you have a system that says that's okay and that's fine, you are ultimately going to breed a generation of people who are so callous, who do not understand the concept of humanity's needs, that they will then use their God-given gifts to destroy the very apparatuses which made their ascension possible. And that apparatus was community, was nation. These people do not believe in nation or community. They believe in more. And that's, you know, the book Plutocrats taught me that. Because progressives have not accepted these things, because, again, they are systemic concepts. And I should have added, when you have a system which exploits enslavement and advocates it as natural, you're going to ultimately produce a group of people that, you know, who are so callous about, you know, humanity. People often shudder about the mob, thinking that, you know, humans were disposable. The mob was nothing compared to capitalism. But when you have progressives who don't understand that, because, you know, I watch these guys and they'll creep up to the point of saying, well, capitalism is bad, but they'll never say it. They'll act as if you need to just kind of critique here and critique there and critique here. And maybe, you know, a screwdriver to put this in and that in and that in and that in. They can't understand that the system is rotted. Because the system was designed to be rotted. I've often said, and I know people don't like me making this comparison, but it is a true comparison. How much cancer is safe in the body? None. None. Talk to any specialist, talk to any a doctor, none. You don't want any cancer in your body. Now, if you have a tumor that is benign, it's not cancerous, okay, as long as it's, you know, not spreading and not causing any problems, okay, well, we can deal with that. But if you get cancer and it's spreading, but if you get cancer, period, that's a problem. That's a problem. And what we have now is a system that has been cancerous. It has been cancerous throughout the world. And for the longest time, Anglo-Europeans have pressed this system onto the world and said that it worked. And other Europeans said, yes, it does, because we benefit greatly from it. The majority of Europeans have said that. A minority hasn't. A minority hasn't. A minority hasn't. And those minorities were called various names. Radicals. Subversives. You know, those are the two most widely utilized. And they were looked down upon by their own brethren. By their own heretical brethren. They were causing problems. The old feudalist trope. You know, the feudal lord has one person who is not towing the line correctly and doesn't like that person. But there's always been a small group. The rest have gone along and it was all great. It was all great. But the reason why is because they didn't want to admit that the system was bad. The system was too close to Europe, you know. It reminded them of being home, or the feudalist system. So it was good. Just like most of the progressives who I hear talking, you know, the system is too comfortable for them. It feels too good, you know. So it can't be all bad. Well, what I tend to point out is that the reason why most of them are hurting financially now and why most of them are speaking out now is because the system was bad. It didn't fulfill its promises. It didn't. And so they're in pain. Well, I'm really going to encourage them to start taking a deep, deep look at the system and trying to figure out what needs to come next. Because capitalism is dying. The question really is what comes next. Capitalism really turned into neoliberalism. And neoliberalism, as a former colonial subject said, this is out of Africa, by the way. This book was written back in 19, I think it was the late 1960s. As he put it, you know, the last stage of colonialism is going to be neocolonialism. And that's exactly where we're at. That's exactly where we're at. And here, I'm not just swinging out on America. I'm not beating up on America here, you know? Because I know that's what a lot of you think. Oh, well, you know, hating America, man. Come on, America's great. No, China is doing this too. But China's doing it with a wink and a nod, so people don't think that's what they're doing. But China is colonizing these countries. They're just doing it with dollar diplomacy. Now, what is it? Z will tell you a different story. But that's exactly what they're doing. And the United States and Europe set up these regions to be colonized by China. Because basically, what these countries are thinking is, we could either get into bed with China, which is going to be beneficial to us. They're going to give us the help that we need to build up our communities, our countries, to build infrastructure. They're going to give us the money that we need to do these things. Or we can stay in bed with the Europeans, who have done nothing for us except exploit us. And I really don't believe most progressives understand just how underdeveloped these places were and have been. Even, and this is something that is noted in from many African countries, the Chinese, many of the Chinese look down on Africans. You know, because a lot of these Chinese look white, so they think they're better than people. But many back in the 80s and the 90s and even the early 2000s used to criticize Africa by saying, you know, why didn't you build up your country once when the imperialists left? And Africans would tell them, a lot of the stuff was destroyed. Some of the stuff the Africans did destroy, which wasn't smart. But a lot of times before the colonists would leave these newly freed countries, they'd tear down infrastructure and buildings that the Africans had actually built and for those countries to utilize. So they tear them down. Those Europeans never colonized China that much to be able to do that. I mean, technically, I'm sorry, I guess I'm lying. They did do that a little bit, but they didn't do it to the extent that they did it in Africa. There was a real disdain and hatred for the Africans freeing themselves after World War II, which the Europeans then used to tear down a lot of the infrastructure. Not all of it, but a lot of it. And the Chinese didn't want to hear that. Well, then why didn't you just build it again? We were trying to, but we had militaries that were coming in here and performing coups every couple of years because they didn't like who we were voting into office. They weren't doing that in China. So the Chinese have been set up by the Anglo-European Alliance to colonize the world. They've been set up to really be prosperous here. So I'm not aligning myself with China. I see what China's doing. They're doing exactly what Europe did. They're going into the Middle East. They're going into Africa. And like a cancerous cell, they're taking out all of the natural extractions because they need them. And in place of, in the process of doing all of that, they're building infrastructure which is going to help those countries continue to funnel them natural extractions. So I know what they're doing. They're not doing anything different than their cousins are doing. But I also know, and this is the biggest fear of the Anglo-European and now the Anglo-Asian alliance, I also know that there will come a day when that relationship will be broken. I know it. And So, you know, they can enjoy extracting what you want out of Africa, because the day's going to come where that's going to be done. And the African continent will bargain from a position of power over both Europe and Asia. But that's another day. That's for another day. It's important for you all to understand, systemically, the reason why it's so hard for many of you to accept where capitalism is and where it's going is because you benefit from it. A lot of the, and you know, I'm definitely going to close this up very shortly, but I want to say that when I hear intersectionalism, I always laugh when I hear about it, because intersectionalism aims to do something which many people had already done before, which is to explain in the context of capitalism various types of oppression. Intersectionalism actually does a lot to confuse those concepts. It does a lot to confuse them. Because, as I've always said to you all, I've never denied, you know, I've never backed away from this concept. You got two ways of organizing the society coming out of Europe. You got caste and you got class. Sex is a caste. But it is not as important as the second caste, which is race. Which is race. And then you have class after that. You have race after, you have class after those two castes. Race is the first caste. Gender, sex, is the second caste. And then you have class. Now, I know for a lot of women, y'all are going to get mad at me for that, but frankly, I don't care. The information stands. The information stands. White women have always had more power than black men. I don't care how you're trying to rewrite history now. I don't care how you're trying to extract, you know, small evidentiary points and say, this is just the truth. They're men, so they got more power than us. When you point to, when you can give to me a list of about 100 white women that died because a black man said, that woman looked at me the wrong way, then we can start to talk. Or you can give me a list of 100 white women that spent their life in jail because a black man said, that woman forced me to have sex, and, you know, that just wasn't what I wanted to do. You're not going to find them. White women have always had more power than black men. That's just the reality. I don't care if you like it. It's where it is. From an economic standpoint, this is massively important, because when we talk about capitalism, power is everything. Power is everything. And so, understanding the relationship between castes, race, sex, and class will help you to understand the power dynamic. Intersectionality only confuses it. It only confuses it. Yeah, I hear them talk about privilege this and privilege that, and then I look at it and go, wait a minute, this isn't, come on, guys, really? The system, the Anglo-European system, was created and crafted to produce economic results. That was the aim of the colonialist expansive projects that the Anglo-European alliance had in mind. And if you don't understand this, I don't care what you bring me academically, you're never going to be able to fully grasp the power dynamics of the society. Do you hear what I'm saying? Do you hear what I'm saying? The ends of the European, the Anglo-European alliance was always economic. If you look up the word economic, it comes from another word, it's a Latin word, which means housekeeping. It means housekeeping. And housekeeping for them has always been about money and the amassing of money. And then you deal with the other cultural, you know, habits that come underneath that. But it's always been about money. And so everything that you're talking about comes down to the power dynamics associated with economy. And then that expands out to the cultural. How you understand those things is how you how you go about understanding those things, how caste and class come together, will help you then, will tell you a lot on how much you actually understand this point. Because people talk about macro and micro economics, but most of them don't talk about the psychological aspects of economics, and most of them don't talk about the historicity of economics. And we are in a period of time where the historicity is being challenged. Okay? When we're talking about privilege, ladies and gentlemen, all you're doing is talking about power. Power. The small little microaggressive things that white men do to make themselves feel powerful, yeah, they're bad. But, you know, you're not really getting at the strain of power. The reason why so many white men were pissed off enough and white women were pissed off enough to vote for Donald Trump really comes down to one thing. They saw their lives flash before their eyes. They saw that in 20 years, their little darling children are going to be in a country with majority non-white people. And guess what that probably means? Most of their little young girls who they are protecting and they don't want really, you know, you get the girls, you shift the demographics of a population. This is why white men used to go in and breed for them. It was breeding with Native Americans and such because they can then change the demographics in their favor. They could, in the mindset, the psychology of the Anglo-European conqueror, they could trick the Native Americans into believing that the European was on their side by going in and breeding with their women and having children, because the Native Americans upheld family in a way that Europeans, the conqueror part of them anyway, did not. So they could shift the dynamics that way. Well, they understand this in their minds that you're going to be in a majority non-white country in about 20, 25 years. I'm even putting it a little bit before that. It wouldn't surprise me if by 2035 it's happening, because there are many states which are beyond the tipping point. They understand this. They understand that little white girls are starting to be more attracted to little black boys. And a lot of little black girls are starting to be wooed by a lot of black little white boys. And so they're a little afraid of that, especially in the Midwest where, you know, you got a lot of white states. In what used to be Indian country. So a lot of women exercise their power to go to that ballot box and make sure that America stayed white. Make America great again. Make America white again. See, it's not MAGA, y'all. It's MAWA. You know, MAWA. That's what it is. It's make America white again. If you do not understand capitalism as a power structure, though, it's hard for you to see this. It's hard for you to see this. It's easy for me to see it because I understand as a power structure, you got caste and you got class. The caste is more important than the class. You have two sections of your caste. You have race and you have gender. Now, ladies and gentlemen, this is not new. It's not as if Anglo-Europeans created this out of thin air. You go back to Europe before colonialism, you had the same structure. It was just, you had it formulated a couple of different ways. So on the one hand, you would have spirituality, religion. So if you were Catholic, you were seen as being better. Then you would have gender. Then you would have gender, and then you would have class. And then in other parts, it would be heritage. You would have heritage, which was usually linked to money, linked to prestige, linked to thrones, things like that. You would have heritage, and in that heritage, you would also have I was going to say journeyman, but it's not journeyman. It's tasks. So, you know, you might be a part of certain guilds. And your family might be part of those guilds for generations. Those guilds would be part of your heritage. So you would have heritage, then you would have gender. And then you would again have the, you know, class and the economic aspect of it, you know. And so these things were always important. It's just when Europe left, when Europeans left Europe, and that Anglo-European system had to go across the world, they needed something that was going to bind them to one another. Race did that. And before it was even called racism, you could see it evolving. At first, they used the same thing as the Catholics did. Well, these are heathens. They, you know, they don't believe what you believe. They're devilish. They're this, they're that. Well, as Europeans came across Native Americans and indigenous people throughout the world who were not in any way threatening, and often, you know, people who would help them survive, you know, that argument didn't hold weight. So then you had to send in your ball-busting managers who, you know, force these people who would sometimes be in really good peaceful alliances with these groups, would force them into acquiescing to these rigid ideologies of, no, these people are heathens. You don't forget that. They're less than you. And if you don't kill them and take their stuff, then, you know, you're a problem to us. And we ain't even sending you back on the boat. We got a shallow grave over here for you. This is how it evolved. This is how it evolved. And if you're not understanding that, then you're not ready to really take on and confront the problems of the modern system. As I stated, this is the beginning of the episode. I know it was pretty long, but there is a part two, I guess. Well, there's a second segment coming up. So, this is your brother, Brian Meredith. I'll see you on the other side. There's a shadow on the faces of the men who sent the guns to the wars that are fought in places where their business interest runs. On the radio, talk shows, and the TV, you hear one thing again and again. How the USA stands for freedom, and we come to the aid of a friend. But who are the ones that we call our friends? These governments killing their own, or the people who finally can't take anymore, and they pick up a gun or a brick or a stone, and they're alive.